This episode of New Politics was released on the 6th of August, 2022, and produced on the land of the Wangal and Whadjuk people.
Welcome to New Politics. In this episode, we look at the proposal for the voice to Parliament. There are tough economic times ahead, but how will the federal government deal with it? And for what it's worth, we assess the latest opinion polls. I'm Eddie Djokovic, editor of New Politics.
I'm David Lewis, bringing you all the hits from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and today's best music.
And a big thank you to our new Patreon subscribers. Thanks for signing up. And if you'd like to support New Politics, you can support us through a Patreon subscription. It's just $5 per month for the Ruby Standard supporter level or $10 per month for the Gold Standard supporter level. But whether it's a subscription or if you just want to listen in, read our material online or buy a t-shirt or buy a book, it's all available at newpolitics.com.au, and all of this is a good way to support independent journalism. The details for the proposed constitutional changes to accommodate the voice of Parliament have been released by the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and it's a fairly straightforward proposition.
Our starting point is a recommendation to add three sentences to the Constitution in recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders as the first peoples of Australia. One, there shall be a body to be called the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice. Two, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice may make representations to Parliament and the Executive Government on matters relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And three, the Parliament shall, subject to this Constitution, have power to make laws with respect to the composition, functions, powers and procedures of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice.
Some have argued that it doesn't go far enough. Some have argued that it's just assuaging whitefella guilt. But it's essentially what was agreed to by 250 Indigenous leaders from all around Australia over a six-month period. And this is what the Indigenous community has asked for from government. And it was a key election promise from the Albanese government to hold a referendum on the voice to Parliament in its first term of office. Now, David, all of this should be clear and straightforward, but in Australia, nothing is clear and straightforward when it comes to referendums.
We don't like to change the Constitution, and there's a whole range of reasons for that. I think it's telling, and I think it's really important to remember that the most successful referendum we held was the 1967 referendum, which moves responsibility for Indigenous affairs from the states to the Commonwealth. This improves some things. It doesn't improve everything. It doesn't fix everything. One of the things it doesn't do is doesn't give Indigenous people citizenship. They already had citizenship. Now, it was a different kind of citizenship, and it was awful, and there were extra taxes they had to pay, and each state had slightly different rules. So if you were someone who travelled around the country, you had to be aware of which state you were in, what the requirements were, and you had to basically be prepared that things weren't any better in any state, just some things were some better in some states sometimes. So when it moved to the Commonwealth, the improvement was in the administration. I think that's fair to say. Whether the administration was good and had good outcomes is a whole other issue. But at least if you were in Perth, if you were in Tennant Creek, if you were in Banana in Queensland, if you're in Warrnambool in Victoria, if you're in Ceduna in South Australia, the rules were at least applied fairly consistently. 90% of people voted in favour of it. 90% of people thought it was a better idea. One of the last speeches John Howard gave to Parliament was him reminiscing about standing on the steps of Town Hall in Sydney with the left-wing mayor of Sydney, Doug Sutherland, handing out vote yes cards to the voters. So it definitely had broad support. The motives for it may have been totally different. I imagine Doug Sutherland thought it was a good idea for different reasons to John Howard thinking it was a good idea. And I'm not going to cast aspersions on either of them there. I'm just going to point that out. It was broadly accepted by the Australian community. Traditionally, referenda have generally required bipartisan support. And I'm wondering if this referendum might just break that tradition.
But I think one of the big issues here is that, and we've discussed this before on New Policies, that any rights that could be provided to Indigenous Australia has to be approved by a system that took those rights away from them in the first place. So it's a moral, historical, ethical, political, legal and social issue. But that's the system that we've got in place at the moment. And that's the legal system that was set up in 1901, and it's almost impossible to change. And the other issue is that many people are asking about the details of what the voice to Parliament is, and that's fair enough. You've got to know what you're voting for before you can vote yes or no. But it seems that many of the people who are demanding more details probably wouldn't vote for it anyway. The Prime Minister only released the proposed constitutional amendments a few days ago, so the details are going to be a little bit sketchy at this stage. The co-chair of the group that designed the Voice to Parliament, Marsha Langton, has said that there's already 500 pages of details that have been released over the past 5 years. So if people want all the details, it's all out there. Now, just like any other group in Australia, there's going to be a broad range of opinions within the Indigenous community. And Senator Jacinda Price and Warren Mundine have said that it won't actually do anything to address Indigenous disadvantage, so they'll actively campaign against it. Here's Senator Price.
We have 10 voices in Parliament. I would be more concerned with some of the issues that, if we're going to support disadvantaged Indigenous people, well, we need to deal directly with the issues that that are affecting them. And personally, I don't see how a voice to Parliament is supposed to actually create any action toward supporting vulnerable and disadvantaged Indigenous Australians.
And on the other side of politics, Green Senator Lydia Thorpe has said that there are other more important issues to implement first, such as the treaty.
Well, it's not only my experience as a senator, it's also my experience as a grassroots black activist, a grandmother, a mother, an auntie, a cousin, a sister, and someone who's fought for country and water all her life. So I think that it's time for treaty. I think we need to stop tinkering around the edges and talking about advisory bodies, which we know we've had over decades. They've all failed. Closing the gap. Like, how many times do we need to be disappointed? Every year we're hearing how bad it is. Treaty is the answer to closing the gap. Treaty is the answer to the issues that our people face in this country, because treaty will give us self-determination to decide our own destiny and our own future.
She has said that she will support the Voice to Parliament, but she just wants other issues implemented first. Now, there seems to be an assumption that governments can only act on one issue at a time, but I don't think it's an either-or situation. Why not both? But over time, we may find that a Voice to Parliament might not be the best solution, but this is what a key group of Indigenous representatives and elders have requested, 250 of them. Now, it's not white people or non-Indigenous people saying, well, this is what you must do, and you know, there's been a history of that since invasion back in 1788. But unfortunately, it is the white and non-Indigenous communities of Australia that have to decide whether constitutional recognition occurs or not. And until that system changes, it's probably the best that can be done at this stage.
I certainly acknowledge that there are going to be Indigenous people who are very untrustworthy of the system. There's going to be some Indigenous people too who might take the view of Senator Neville Bonner, who was the first Indigenous senator appointed to the Australian Parliament. And he was a monarchist, and his argument for being a monarchist is that it's a system that we've worked within, or that they've worked within, for 200 years, and they'd made certain progresses and they knew how the system worked, whereas a new republican system might change things altogether and a lot of the gains would be lost. I'm not here either to tell someone how racism works and doesn't work in their own personal experience especially. I don't have the experience of that, and it would be very wrong of us to attempt that. But I think the government has done what it sees as a fairly decent job in trying to get as much of a broad consensus as you possibly can. The two assumptions that the, we'll call them, the less progressive media make about Indigenous culture, one, which we don't need to discuss here, is that Indigenous people can't run things properly because they're fighting all the time. Unlike, say, the Liberal parties of Victoria and New South Wales, which are brilliantly run organisations at the moment, for example. The other assumption that's made is that there is a monoculture in Australian Indigenous views where everybody agrees. Now, this is arrant nonsense. Of course, people don't agree. And there'll be people voting yes who don't fully agree in the Indigenous communities, who don't fully agree with this but think it better than other alternatives. There'll be those voting no who like the general idea but think it could be better, just like the rest of society. I think we have to be careful in finding voices that we agree or disagree with and saying this represents the whole of Indigenous culture, and that's okay. Nothing will represent the whole, but I think the majority of the leaders of Indigenous culture are prepared to give this a go. There is a chance in which there's just one shot because of the nature of how to change, although I note the question is very broad and will allow for tweaks to be made without having to go to another referendum. And I think that's a smart thing, and any question should be couched in those ways. Get it into the Constitution and then use legislation to fix it, which was the mistake of the Republican referendum in 1999. They tried to get us to agree to a model rather than saying, should Australia be a republic? And then having the argument based on yes or no. And then you can go back to the people and say, well, which one do we want? And it might be the same for this, that we get the voice to Parliament in, and then we can work out the details based on those 500 pages. And the other thing, I'll admit, I haven't read the 500 pages. But as we get closer to the date, I'm sure a lot of the ideas will come out.
And David, you referred to some of those issues that relate to referenda question and how difficult it is to pass in Australia. But of the 44 referendum questions that have been put to the Australian electorate since 1901, only 8 of those have passed. And even sensible propositions such as recognition of local councils, freedom of religion, guaranteed rights and freedoms, and fair elections, all of these have been defeated in the past. So it's actually hard to believe that Australia voted against a constitutional change to guarantee fair elections, but that's exactly what happened in the 1988 referenda, where all of these propositions had strong public support before the referendums were held, but there was a group of opposition led by Peter Reith, and I'm sure that our audience would remember who this guy is. He used it to boost his profile with Conservatives in the Liberal Party and then became a senior minister in the Howard government. And on the day of the referendums in 1988, all of these proposals were defeated by 2/3. And there were some other factors involved here. The Hawke government was becoming more unpopular at that time. There wasn't any bipartisan support at all. And there was that same old Australian argument that if ain't broke, don't fix it. But essentially, 4 good constitutional changes were easily defeated, all because the bad seeds in Australian politics were allowed to do their dirty work. And generally, a constitution that is so difficult to change and only amended 8 times in 121 years, in my opinion, is not such a good constitution. There's also the issue of the double majority, where a successful referendum needs a majority of voters and a majority of the states. So you can have a high popular vote and lose the referendum, which is what happened in the 1977 referendum to hold simultaneous elections of the House of Representatives and the Senate. That actually received a 62% yes vote, but was only passed by 3 of the 6 states, so it was defeated. So all you need for the voice to Parliament to be defeated is for the opponents and opportunists to campaign strongly in the smaller states, Tasmania, South Australia and Western Australia, and that's the end of the referendum.
And this is why we have the majority of states. The authors of the Constitution, and I refuse to use the term founding fathers, thinking that American nonsense, but the authors of the Constitution were worried that, and this is similar to the American Constitution too with their electoral college, that the smaller states would lose out with the population centres being Sydney and Melbourne. If Sydney and Melbourne vote as a solid block for something that they like, that pretty much is a 50% majority. So the idea was that the states were able to be protected. The issue there becomes, should the rest of Australia be held to a minority? And before you people in South Australia, Tasmania, Western Australia, I actually do think it's fair enough. And we can see where the model fails when we look at the recent British plebiscite on Brexit, where Cameron didn't think to put a majority of people in a majority of countries, so Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales and England. And that may have changed the vote to the one that he wanted, which was for Britain to remain and close the debate down. But because he went for a straight majority, England voted, particularly Northern England, voted solidly in favour of Brexit. Wales voted in favour, but everywhere else voted against. They might not have got through. I do think, just looking at the general, one, the popularity of the Labour government at the moment, which may not last, to the unpopularity of the Liberal Party at the moment and the National Party at the moment, which again may not last, and the general positive feeling for Indigenous representation, this may well be a referendum that passes with bipartisan support. It will depend on the smaller states, but I think the smaller states might come through.
Now, we are getting more into constitutional issues than anything else, but I think it is a question of what does the Australian Constitution mean to the Australian people? There are many conservatives who claim that the Constitution is well-defined. It's what keeps Australia safe and it shouldn't be changed at all, but there's no mention of the Prime Minister in the Constitution. There's no mention of the Cabinet and how that should be constituted. New Zealand is mentioned in the Constitution as a potential state of Australia, so it's not as clear as some people would like to think it is. But the proposed changes are deliberately loose. It just guarantees the existence of a voice to Parliament, and it's still up to governments to define it in the future. They could almost do whatever they want with it. They could defund it. They could put their own people onto it. I'd actually be asking for a lot more, but constitutional lawyers have argued that constitutions should contain flexibility for future governments to act, hopefully for improvements. But if you do have that flexibility, that means that governments could act detrimentally towards a voice to Parliament, and I guess that could be one of the problems. The other factor is that a voice to Parliament doesn't actually need a referendum and a constitutional change for it to be created. The federal government could create this tomorrow if they wanted to, along with everything else from the Uluru Statement and the Makarrata, but then it would be at the whim of future governments, which is what happened with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission. That was created by a Labor government in 1990 and then removed by the Howard government in 2005 and not replaced with anything. But a voice to Parliament with constitutional recognition is what Indigenous people, or at least a key group of Indigenous people, this is what they've requested of government. And I think because of this, this is why it should be supported.
The easy thing would be to make it part of the Executive Council. It could be just, yep, Cabinet. And in part of Cabinet is an Indigenous voice. The fear is that another Scott Morrison goes in and gives it to somebody like Twiggy Forrest or someone who's always been a friend to the Indigenous people. And I say that with all the irony and sarcasm I can muster. This may be why that the Labor government has decided we will entrench it in the Constitution, which makes it harder to remove. It would take another referendum to remove it. And if it gets in, getting it out will be harder, because once people realise that it's not a third chamber, as Barnaby Joyce will no doubt argue in the next couple of weeks, he's already argued that when it was first brought up, that it's not going to move a lot of privilege away from the people who already have it. It will hopefully give privilege to those who don't. And if I'm being a bit idealistic and wide-eyed here, it's because shouldn't we hope for the best? I think, yeah, had they brought it in as one, legislation, or two, as a new position on the Executive Council, or three, as an envoy to the Governor General, should a later, less friendly government get in, they'd remove it. And it wouldn't necessarily be a Liberal government who does that, by the way. Malcolm Fraser received a smoking ceremony at his funeral. So there's all kinds of quirks and issues to consider. My point is that once it's hammered into the Constitution, unless we totally remove the Constitution, it will be there permanently, and future governments will have problems removing it. And one of the things I've been saying for quite some time is one of the weaknesses of our Constitution is that it doesn't recognise our Indigenous cultures as much as it should, apart from saying Indigenous affairs are now part of the remit of the Commonwealth. This type of thing, I would argue, is potentially a great thing to start the next step of the process of reconciliation, to bring in the negotiations for a treaty. to start solving the problems of poverty and all of the things that poverty brings, to start improving access to opportunity. We've seen that people like Marsha Langton have enriched Australian society. I think we need more of that important voice right throughout society.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au, and you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
Gather around, people, I'll tell you a story, an 8-year long story of power and pride. British Lord Vesty and Vincent Lingiari were opposite men on opposite sides.
Vesty was fat with money and muscle. Beef was his business and broad was his door. Vincent was lean and spoke very little. He had no bank balance. Hard dirt was his floor.
From little things, big things grow. 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 From little things, big things grow.
Interest rates have gone up again, and this will start putting pressure on the federal government to address cost of living issues and fix up a poorly performing economy. The new government has only been in office for 10 weeks, and they can't be held responsible for economic problems that have developed over the past decade, but they do have to start addressing these issues. They are the government after all, and if you're not going to start repairing these problems, well, there's no point in being there. Inflation is going up as well, and real wages are not expected to rise over the next 18 months. But the good news is that according to research produced by the School of Economics at the University of Sydney, whenever Labor has been in office, they've been able to manage the issues of real interest rates, inflation and growth. And just because they've been better at this in the past doesn't mean that it will happen again. But managing the economy over the next 5 years is going to be quite a difficult process.
They were handed, I believe the term is, a hospital pass. And I think it deliberately set up one too, in part of a strategy to get the Liberal Party re-elected the next term. $1 trillion debt is not great, only because there's nothing to show for it. $1 trillion debt, and we've put in new renewable power, we've put in a brilliant internet, we've fixed the infrastructure around the country. That's fine. $1 trillion debt, and it's gone on Barnaby Joyce's envoy and Micaiah Cash being able to fly around the country buying units on a whim and Scott Morrison doing whatever he did for the last 3 years. That's not good. That's what we've been spending it on. Dr. Chalmers is a very knowledgeable economist, and it seems that he does know what he's talking about, and he's warning of pain. Unemployment will rise. Interest rates, they say they're going to peak in August. Money will tighten. Prices will go up, inflation will rise, the dollar will devalue, making things a little bit harder.
So the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, he has started pushing out the messages that the economy is going through some very difficult challenges over the next 5 years, and that's certainly going to be the case based on what we know at the moment.
In the pre-election forecast released a little more than 3 months ago, inflation was expected to peak at 4.25%. It's already 6.1% through the year to June, and now forecast to peak at 7.75% in the December quarter this year. The current expectation is that it will get worse this year, moderate next year, and normalise the year after. We haven't reached the peak yet, but we can see it from here. Inflation will unwind again, but not in an instant. The harsh truth is that households won't feel the benefits of higher wages while inflation eats up these wage increases, and then some. The economic picture I've set out today represents a convergence of challenges, the kind of which comes around once in a generation. But this once-in-a-generation challenge represents a once-in-a-generation opportunity for our country as well. We have it within us to stare down these threats, to steer our way through this difficult period and seize the opportunities of this new age, with an economy and a budget as resilient as the Australian people themselves.
Now, there are suggestions that this is a deferred inflation caused by lower spending levels during the earlier parts of the pandemic and higher levels of saving, and consumers are now spending the money that was not spent before. Now, that's not everybody. People on lower income spend whatever money they've got. So that would mainly be the middle and upper level income levels that would have saved the money and they're now spending it. So it's just a question of whether it's a short-term inflation that will peter out once that excess consumer spending has been spent, and or whether there's other issues such as the war in Ukraine causing supply issues. But the war in Ukraine isn't going to go on forever, and even if it did, well, world markets do have a way of reorganizing their supply issues. And we also have to remember that we're still in a pandemic economy. There's a lot of worker shortages and people not being able to work because of COVID, and there's a flow-on effect throughout the rest of the economy caused by that. But this is where the political narrative comes into it. If Jim Chalmers warns the community about the difficult times ahead for the next few years, and then the economy returns to some kind of natural economic equilibrium, with all those inflationary issues knocked back and the cost of living pressures under control, well, he'll be hailed as some kind of economic genius. And if not, his economic competence will be questioned and he'll be regarded as a weak and poor treasurer. So I think that controlling the narrative about the economy is almost as important as controlling the economy itself.
For sure. Paul Keating, one of the better treasurers we had, got into a lot of trouble by explaining why the economy had to slow down, and he called it the recession we had to have, which, of course, for people who were feeling the bite of this recession, for people who perhaps understood that there were other ways of approaching rather than the softened free market neoliberal approach of Keating, the recession we had to have was probably very avoidable and could have been dealt with in a different way. And Keating lost a lot of skin, particularly from a relatively hostile media back then too, by using a phrase that he said, honestly, he wasn't trying to sweeten anything except by saying, well, we have to have this to fix things. He was kind of right in that when the economy improved, it was better. But was the 2 or 3 years of high interest rates, of high unemployment, of wasted labor, of wasted productivity, of wasted opportunity worth it? I'm not going to argue that here, but the point is that a treasurer needs to be able to communicate good news and bad news. And of course, you can't blame a politician for being a politician. Everything's going to get some kind of positive spin on it eventually, unless it's about the other side. And so when Dr. Chalmers says, you know, it's going to be hard, we know that down the track, he's probably got several projections. He's hoping that they'll be able to follow the better projections, but he's preparing us all for the worst projections so that in the worst case, he can say, well, we told you it was going to be hard, but we're nearly through it. If the better projections come through, it's like, well, look at how well we managed this. We were expecting this, but in fact, we're out of it a much sooner than we can. And that's just politicians being politicians. That's neither good nor bad. That's just the way it is.
So Paul Keating did lose some political skin back in 1990 when he did say that this is the recession that we needed to have. But we have to remember that he did go on to become Prime Minister after that, and he was in politics for another 6 years after he made those comments. So he did lose some political skin at the time, but it didn't deter him from becoming Prime Minister. Some members of the government have been suggesting that the electorate has to be reminded about the coalition's wasteful time in office, and they have to keep pushing the $1 trillion national government debt the previous government left behind. And in comparison, the former Liberal Party Treasurer, Peter Costello, he constantly reminded the electorate about Beazley's $10 billion black hole after Labor lost office in 1996, even though Kim Beazley was the finance minister and not the treasurer. So you'd think that if the Liberal Party was able to gain political mileage for almost a decade, over a $10 billion national government debt. You'd expect the Labor Party to inflict some sort of political damage with a national government debt left behind that's 1,000 times greater. But generally, I agree with you, David, that treasurers do need to be very good communicators. They have to weave a strong economic message that makes sense to the community and appear to be on top of all the economic issues. Now, I'm not suggesting that all a successful treasurer needs to do is mesmerise the electorate with some fancy words or be Shakespearean in their delivery, and that's the end of their job. They have to explain these messages to different audiences, the electorate, the finance industry, bankers, money markets, the share market. And if any of those audiences think that the treasurer is not on top of their brief, well, they'll be found out pretty quickly, I think.
We've had, shall I say, some pretty poor treasurers over the last 9 years. Joe Hockey, who is somehow better than Scott Morrison, who is somehow better than Josh Frydenberg. These were men who couldn't understand what the average Australian was doing, how the average Australian was working, and who really just carved the economy up for themselves and their donors. Looking around for good things that the last government did was really hard. There were bits and pieces, but not much.
I think this is one of those circumstances where Labor is governing under difficult economic circumstances.
Oh, for sure.
There was World War One, World War Two, the hyperinflation and oil crisis in the early 1970s, the recession in 1983, the world recession in the early 1990s, the global financial crisis, and now the pandemic economy and massive levels of national debt. Now, one advantage for Labor is that Jim Chalmers was an advisor to the Rudd government during the global financial crisis. Andrew Charlton was a senior economics advisor at the time as well, and he's the new member for Parramatta. Now, I'm not suggesting that being an advisor bears the same responsibility as being the treasurer or an MP as part of the government, but they saw what an economic crisis looks like close up, and that should be a valuable experience. So Jim Chalmers is an inexperienced treasurer, but so was Paul Keating in 1983, as was Wayne Swan in 2007. And they successfully managed the Australian economy during difficult times. So Chalmers will have to learn very quickly and implement solutions very, very quickly. And Labor hasn't been in office for very much since Federation. We've pointed this out quite a few times on New Politics, only 31% of the time since 1901. But their time in office mainly coincides with difficult economic circumstances. So while there might be a case where there's that historical perception that the coalition are better economic managers, which several academic papers have shown to be not actually be the case, there might be a historical perception that it's the Labor Party that comes into office to fix up economic problems. Now, I'm not too sure if there's a direct correlation there, but historically it does seem to be the case.
It makes sense that governments change when things are going badly. And till Scott Morrison, you generally got another go. You won the first election or you got appointed, then you won the next one because people want to give, I think, all governments a chance to fix up what they've done. I think Labor comes in, and you're right, World War One, Great Depression, World War Two, otherwise known as the good old days. They nearly win in 61 where there's a credit squeeze and we head into another recession, but Menzies scrapes back by one seat. 72, you get the start of the oil crisis, which profoundly affects the world. 83, we head straight into a recession. 2007, the GFC. And one of the things that Labor is very bad at is reminding people that it fixes the GFC, that it fixes the economy in the 1980s, that the only two Australian treasurers to get Best Treasurer Award are Wayne Swan and Paul Keating. No Liberal treasurer has ever got that. And we've got to remember, too, that these are from conservative-leaning or right-leaning magazines. I'm not so wrapped in giving treasurers awards, but it was an acknowledgement that they were able to manage a difficult economy quite well. And Labor's not great at reminding people of that. And that's maybe something that they should start doing. And that Dr. Chalmers is the next in a long line of highly capable Labor treasurers.
Now, whatever the case might be, the economy is still the key issue for the electorate, irrespective of which government is in office. Now, it's probably the case that in the first 2 years of the pandemic, people's health was the priority and probably still is now, but in most cases, it's the economy that matters. And Labor has to manage the economy practically and politically, and it's pushed that message that these problems are so immense that it will take years to resolve. Whether the electorate believes that is another issue, but as long as there is a plan or an understanding that there is a clear direction for resolving these problems, that might end up being enough. But the opposition over the past fortnight, they've been putting out their messages as well. Well, we all know how terrible the economy is, but you know, that's one thing, but where's Labor's plan? And I do love the irony there. And that's a message that the opposition has been thumping consistently over the past few weeks. But Labor seems to be more keen on identifying the problems first. And there is that philosophical idea that every problem in the world has a solution at any given time, but it's a matter of correctly identifying what the problem is. And if the applied solution doesn't work, it's not that the solution was incorrect, it was applied to the wrong problem. And that can also apply to economic problems. If the economic issue of the day isn't correctly identified and analysed, well, you're not going to get the right solution. And I do realise that economic analysis is a little bit like three-dimensional chess and a few cryptic crosswords thrown in as part of the deal. But that's going to be the key here, correct identification of the economic problems and applying the correct economic solution.
At least those of us on the progressive side of things have acknowledged that neoliberalism is dead, that it's a model that never worked, and after 30 years of in the long run we'll all be rich, well, we're in the long run and we're not rich, and it's failed. There's a whole range of other. We can revert back to Keynesianism. There's the modern monetary theory. There's all kinds of ideas like that. And I know that Dr. Chalmers has all of these at his fingertips. Which one he will eventually go with will have a whole range of reasons as to why he goes with it. There's actually a real opportunity here to not only modernize the Australian economy, but to bring it into the future and future-proof it. Whether he can do that or not remains to be seen, and whether that's part of his purview remains to be seen. Now is the time to look at all kinds of options.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au, and you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
And there is a new opinion poll that's just been released. It's the latest news poll, and it shows that the Labor government and Anthony Albanese are in a very strong position. Now, opinion polling at this time of the electoral cycle is just fun and games, and David, you and I like fun and games, not all the time, but just sometimes. Now, it doesn't really mean that much, but it just gives an opportunity to see how the respective political parties are travelling. At the moment, 61% of people approve of Albanese's performance. He's the preferred Prime Minister over Peter Dutton by 59% to 25%. And the two-party preferred voting is 56% for Labor and 44% for the Coalition. Generally, after an election, the incumbents have a high approval rating. The electorate is pretty much verifying the decision that they made at the recent federal election. But these are not very good signs for Peter Dutton and the Liberal National parties. Now, they're not terminal, far from it, but they're not in very good shape at the moment.
No, he's missed a 25%, one of the lower opposition leaders. Now, to be fair, he's come off the back of a devastating election for the Liberal Party. For all their claims that they won the popular vote, it doesn't matter. Labor and others won more of the seats, and that's what it gets down to in a Westminster system. We've said this before, but it bears repeating. And they didn't really win the popular vote. They didn't get anywhere near 50% either. Peter Dutton was never the most popular of ministers. That's fair to say. And it must be frustrating for him to see someone with the capability and charisma of Scott Morrison become Prime Minister while Dutton languishes in opposition without any clear path to becoming Prime Minister as it stands. There's rumours already circulating that he'll be gone by Christmas, that they'll be putting someone in to really rebuild the party. They don't quite say who, and I suspect at this point we'd be able to quote Pete Townsend again, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. But I will be fair to him. The Liberal Party's in a very difficult position at the moment. And if his ranking was much higher than 25%, I would call that some kind of miracle. So his diehards are still clinging on.
Now, both the government and the opposition are still getting used to their new positions. Some MPs have gone searching for their old offices, only to be reminded that they're in a different part of Parliament House in Canberra. All of this is new and different, and it's too early in the political cycle to read anything much into these polls. But my feeling is that not much is going to change if the Liberal Party doesn't understand the results of the 2022 election. And so far, it seems like they're not understanding that. They're not quite getting the message. The opposition leaders already refused to accept a push from Liberal Party moderates to accept and pass Labor's emissions reductions target of 43%. And the argument was, or the theory was, that Labor would then have a massive battle with the Australian Greens to get legislation through. It would fail, and then it would be the carbon tax debates and the climate wars all over again, and the Liberal Party would reap the political benefits from all the mayhem. Well, this is what's happened this week. Here's Adam Bandt, the leader of the Australian Greens.
And that's why I can tell you today that tomorrow I will be joined by our Greens MPs in the House of Representatives in voting for the climate change bill. And when the bill comes before the Senate, we will vote for it there as well.
The climate change legislation has now been passed by the lower house and it will go to the Senate next month for approval. So as we've discussed on new policies before, 43% is woefully inadequate. But as we've argued before, this is a stepping stone and it would be easier to go from a 43% target to a much higher level than it is to go from 26%, which is the current level adopted by the coalition. So this is a good and wise decision from the Australian Greens. But the other problem for the Liberal Party is that Bridget Archer, the Liberal MP in the seat of Bass, she's followed through with her threat to cross the floor on climate change legislation. So Dutton has been defeated on policy, he's been defeated on ideas, he's been defeated politically with this issue, and it seems like they're going to keep using this failed strategy, and I'm not sure where this is going to end up for them.
I think they're fighting the battles that they've won in the past. Every interview I did with the Teal candidates, and we spoke to Kylie Tink and we spoke to Georgia Steele and we spoke to Jane Caro, who wasn't a Teal candidate, she was running with Reason Party. But every independent interview we did, they all mentioned the environment and the coalition's lack of good policy on the environment as to why they were running. Some of them admitted that they were previously Liberal voters who agreed in broad principle with the philosophy and principles of the Liberal Party, but couldn't live with the appalling environment. Now, remnants of the party are very much tied up with their donors who come from the extractive industries, mining, coal, gas, petrol, etc. And it seems a lot of money is being given to them to win these elections by those industries and companies and donors. The trouble is that money alone doesn't win elections. It makes it easier to win elections. Get better advertising campaigns, you can get flashier PR stunts, etc. But ultimately, it is the Australian people. And if the Australian people have decided we want a better environment and we need to fix it, and we need to fix it as quickly as humanly possible, all the money in the world won't change that. And of course, enough of the population has lived through 3 or 4 once in a 100-year rainstorms leading to 3 or 4 once in a 100-year floodings over the last 6 to 12 months. Extreme drought, bushfires at a much higher level than we've ever had them, weird and unseasonal weather. And we're looking at Britain and seeing 40 degree days in an infrastructure that's not built for 40 degrees, that can barely handle 35 degrees, and hoping that they'll be all right. Meanwhile, we're freezing to death over here because we're getting much colder winters than we're used to, at least on the coast. So the Liberal Party isn't going to improve its position anytime soon till it brings itself in line with the broader values of the Australian people.
And I think the less things change, the more They will say the same for the coalition. They've got a strange group of people within their ranks at the moment. Now, we've maintained for a long time on new politics that they weren't very well equipped for government, and now they're showing themselves to be ill-equipped for opposition as well. Paul Fletcher is the manager of opposition business, and he just doesn't seem to know what to do with parliamentary tactics. Angus Taylor, as shadow treasurer, has a huge credibility problem. Susan Ley, she's the deputy leader. She had a very ordinary week in parliament. And they're pushing all of these issues that they hope will give them some traction. They talked about a $275 reduction in power bills that Labor promised. Well, where's the $550 that Tony Abbott promised in 2013 when he repealed carbon pricing? That never happened. And I know that being in opposition is very, very, very hard work, and Labor knows all about that. During their 9 years of opposition, they rarely got any traction at all from their parliamentary tactics, and quite often you'd wonder how they'd ever be able to get any developments or any achievements at all through Parliament. But Anthony Albanese, when he was opposition leader, he consistently said that Labor would be a constructive opposition and offer support to the government, especially during the difficult early stages of the pandemic in 2020 and 2021. And he's now the Prime Minister. So there might be some lessons in there for the coalition in opposition. Be constructive and not destructive. But it just seems like they can't redeem themselves. They're still deciding whether they'll support the voice to Parliament. Already, the Western Australian Liberal Party membership base has said that they will vote against it. Tony Abbott has come out to say that he won't support it. And of course, he's no longer in Parliament, but he still does have influence within the conservative base of the Liberal Party. And all of these messages the Liberal Party were given by the electorate at the last election are just totally being ignored. And for me, that takes a special kind of arrogance, that you're just not prepared to listen to what the people who can vote you in or vote you out are telling you. And I just find that incredibly bizarre and counterproductive.
There's clearly a Liberal-leaning voter who would vote for the party if it had better policies on the environment. And probably that's all it needs. Again, it goes back to those teal candidates in the once-safe Liberal seats. And I'm only calling them teal to be lazy, by the way. I know that they're all properly independent. We remember the green and we forget that there's the blue in there. Now, this doesn't offend me. There's no way that a safe seat such as Kooyong was ever going to vote for a Labor-left socialist candidate. Not this election anyway. Maybe in 10 or 12 elections, the demographics might change, et cetera, et cetera. While the Liberal Party refuses to acknowledge that the people have moved on, Bertolt Brecht, who asked in a satirical poem, is it time for the government to dissolve the people and elect another? And I think that's what the Liberal Party want to do. They want themselves in government being voted in by themselves. And the people have moved on, and the country has moved on, and the country has looked at what they've delivered, given them 9 years, found that it hasn't done anything, and moved them on. I suppose we should be fair that Peter Dutton and Suzanne Ley and all of them are consistent. They have held on to their principles. Whether those principles are any good is a whole other debate, and I think we all know the answer to that. The Liberal Party is in crisis around the country. New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland, Western Australia, it basically doesn't exist. South Australia, it's licking its wounds. Tasmania is a much different stripe of Liberal Party to its mainland colleagues. ACT, it's basically not there. Northern Territory, it's in tatters.
That's it for this episode of New Politics. Thanks for listening in. If you'd like to support our style of journalism and commentary, please make a donation at our website at newpolitics.com.au. We don't beg, plead, beseech or gaslight you about journalism coming to an end. We just keep it very simple. If you like what we do, please send some support our way. It keeps our commitment to independent journalism ticking along. I'm Eddie Djokovic. Thanks for listening in, and it's goodbye to our listeners.
I'm David Lewis. We'll see you next time.